Welcome again. I'm Craig McClure, Executive Director of the IIS. This morning, I'm really pleased to have with me the four speakers from today's plenary session. The theme of the plenary today was Advancing Treatment and Universal Access, a report on state-of-the-art and progress. The speakers provided us with key on-the-ground perspectives, as well as international perspectives and calls to action, and important new data, and a vision for the future of HIV treatment. As per usual, I'm going to introduce each of the speakers in turn to give very brief remarks on summaries of their talks, and then we'll open it up for questions. Our first presenter this morning was Dr. Julio Montaner of the BC Center for Excellence in HIV and AIDS, and will become and the incoming president-elect of the International AIDS Society. Dr. Montaner.
In brief, I tried to outline in my presentation today, firstly, the dramatic evolution that highly active antiretroviral therapy has had over the last decade. When we look back at Vancouver, there was the birth of a new way of approaching treatment for HIV, aiming for full suppression of viral replication. But very rapidly, we realized that those treatments were cumbersome, they were difficult, and that they had a number of side effects and toxicities that precluded the long-term benefit of the patients that most needed it. Great efforts have gone on to simplify therapy, and I'm not going to repeat the presentation, but I think that the fixed dose combination tablets that we now have available in North America, in particular, or in Europe, are very much an improvement on previous approaches. There are some fixed-dose combinations in the south of the world. More needs to be done to spread this approach widely. The recent approval of a triple, the single one pill once a day regimen, should have an impact on everything we're doing. But then I moved on to discuss the concerns that we have regarding the sustainability of the antiretroviral therapy effort, not just in the south of the world, but also in the north of the world. We're currently very concerned about this, and as a result, we started to explore the potential that highly active antiretroviral therapy could have on enhancing our prevention efforts. And I emphasize, and I will emphasize it every time, this is not to replace prevention, this is to strengthen prevention over and beyond the traditional prevention measures and over and above the current efforts to expand prevention, which are the top priority. We cannot ignore the fact that highly active antiretroviral therapy has the potential to decrease infectiousness, and therefore in an environment where prevention continues to be strengthened, should have a significant decrease on new cases of HIV just by doing what is right, which is to treat people with HIV who need treatment. Beyond that, we have created a hypothesis, which is simply a hypothesis that requires a lot more work, but really is very interesting because it tells us that if one day we were to have a simple treatment that is free of side effects, that is readily available, we could envision that this treatment could come together to synergize with current prevention strategies to help us get rid of HIV in the world, or at least control the expansion of HIV in the world in a dramatic fashion. I think I'll leave it at that and I'll answer any questions you may have. My main goal, though, with this kind of thinking is to provide a further argument for the expansion of antiretroviral therapy to those in need of in medical need of antiretroviral therapy in the world today. As I said earlier, $1 invested on antiretroviral therapy is cost-effective for the patient, but it also generates a $2 saving, additional dollar saving, in the prevention equation. So this is very important. Thank you.
Thanks, Julio. Our second speaker today was Dr. Ruth Ndwati of the College of Health Sciences at the University of Nairobi, who presented on issues related to treatment of care of children with HIV and AIDS.
Thank you, Craig. My presentation this morning was very focused on the issues of children and AIDS, and in particular in sub-Saharan Africa. I began my discussion with contextualizing HIV, that this epidemic is evolving in the midst of a chronic crisis of child health and poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. And the problems of poverty aggravate the HIV epidemic, and the HIV epidemic in turn aggravates the poverty that is being experienced. I highlighted that every year we have, in spite of having interventions that can prevent mother-child transmission of HIV, every year we have more than 600,000 new infections. I think the figures are maybe like 800,000 new infections, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa. We have 14 million orphan children in that region, and that the issues of adult illness affect children, other children, for example, lack of food security. It interferes with children's learning when teachers stay away from school. I talked a little bit about the rapid course of illness in children, which is much more rapid than in adults, the very high mortality of HIV-infected kids, but then the reality that these children respond well to treatment when it is provided. And the challenge facing us now is how to roll out the care, you know, the prevention and the care for of HIV-exposed children. I talked a bit on the issues of testing and integrating HIV testing as a provider-initiated testing at all points of contact in the healthcare system where children are accessing care, whether it is in a maternal child health clinic or whether in inpatient services. I also highlighted the issues of the chronic shortage of healthcare providers, making it very difficult to deliver these services, and the progress made in the region in developing training resources and collaborations that will hopefully go towards scaling up care for kids and also carrying out the necessary research to support this public health approach to HIV care for young children as well as their families. Again, I'll be happy to answer specific questions around the presentation I made.
Thank you, Ruth. Our third speaker today was Dr. Agnes Binigwa, the head of Rwanda's National AIDS Control Commission, who discussed critical issues related to prevention and treatment and outlined some of the successes and challenges in sustaining Rwanda's HIV/AIDS response.
Thank you very much, Gray. I had the honor this morning to talk about giving the perspective of a developing country who is doing well in the field of the fight against HIV/AIDS. But I can summarize my presentation in 10 issues. First of all, we should know that universal access to treatment and prevention are indivisible, equally critical, and complementary. There is no doubt and no way to go to fight HIV/AIDS in another manner. Secondly, we need to political tools and technical good tools to fight HIV/AIDS. And we have to situate the fight against HIV/AIDS in the overall MDG approach. All the eight goals have to be tackled. The third thing is that we need to think about the feminization of the HIV epidemic. We need to give special tools to the women to have access. That means we need then, again, political commitment and legislation adapted to the fact that the woman has not the same right. Even if on paper they have the same right. Culturally, they don't go to take their rights. So we need a special approach for the woman to have this access to care, treatment, and prevention. Never forget that among the population of 15 to 24 years old, 75% of HIV positive person are young women, 75. The third thing I would like to say is that we need to succeed in the fight against HIV/AIDS to integrate fully the fight in the sectors and to run for the 3-1 principle, strengthening the national institution, because those institutions are the spinal cord of services who will remain after all the projects we are going on now. The fifth one is that we have a big constraint, is the majority of the fight against HIV/AIDS is externally financed, so we need to be careful with the end of those projects. And many interventions were underfunded. Mostly no one wants to fund the nutrition part of that. We all know that nutrition is absolutely crucially necessary for the people to swallow even their tablet in the beginning. And the sustainability issue of IV therapy remains beyond the financial means of the majority of developing countries. And there is a balance to do between investment and human source gap and running project. Also, I would like to appeal for some institution like organization like FAO, we say in French. In my point of view, they don't do their job. They are in Africa from years and years, and I don't understand why our people in agricultural area who are not more stupid than us doesn't catch up. So I think that they should change their way to work. And after that, I appeal for support to scientists for helping them to find a good vaccine and to find the true microbicide who can help women, because this will be the only way they don't have to negotiate for sex risk. And almost that's it.
Okay, thank you very much, Agnes. I think we're going to want to open it up to questions quite soon. So our fourth speaker was Dr. Kevin De Kock, who's the director of the HIV and AIDS Department at the World Health Organization.
Thank you very much. My presentation was really in two parts. Firstly, assessing where we are with global treatment scale-up, and then secondly, discussing what universal access may mean and what the role of the health sector is. As of the end of June of this year, WHO estimates that there were 1.65 million people on antiretroviral therapy in low and middle income settings, including over 1 million Africans. Global coverage is about 24%. And this does represent a very substantial achievement over the past 2.5 years, although there's obviously a great deal more to be done. Looking at equity, the things that stand out are the very limited progress with mother-to-child transmission prevention, with the treatment of children, and with the treatment of injecting drug users. And those are probably the three biggest issues in terms of inequity in scale-up. As far as treatment outcomes is concerned, drugs clearly work as well in the south as they do in the north. Adherence is excellent, but there are two major problems. One is that patients are starting on therapy too late, diagnosed too late, started too late with advanced disease. And secondly, the issue of user fees is a real problem, because it is a risk factor for poor adherence, and in fact has been shown to be associated with adverse outcome, including increased rate of death. As far as moving towards universal access is concerned, WHO has prioritized 5 strategic directions for the health sector working towards universal access, and these are expanding testing and counseling, maximizing prevention, accelerating treatment scale-up, strengthening health systems, and investing in strategic information. And I finished the talk with some slightly more detailed consideration of a very important issue of provider-initiated testing and counseling. That's the HIV testing and counseling in healthcare settings for diagnosis, treatment, and care. WHO and UNAIDS will be issuing guidance on this later this year, this rather important and somewhat a topic of some discussion at this conference.
Thanks, Kevin. Okay, we'll open it up. I know that, Larry, you had a question that you asked just before we began. Would you like to? No? Okay. Let's take it from the floor. Go ahead. And please stand up and say your name and your affiliation.
Okay, Morgan Kamal from Gender and Development, Oxfam. My question is to WHO. We talk about universal access to treatment. And there's two things that are happening now that worry us about access. One is the fallout of the TRIPS implementation in India, with companies filing for patent for drugs that are basic treatment now, according to WHO guidelines. And the second thing is the U.S. free trade agreements that are blocking or will be blocking access to new medicines. And I'm just wondering what's the role of WHO, what WHO would do about that. Thank you.
Let me make two comments. One is that obviously WHO's view, what WHO believes, that access to therapy should be as broad as possible with the best quality drugs for the greatest number of people at the lowest possible prices. The spokesperson here for issues around intellectual property, selected by our Director General, our Acting Director General, is actually Dr. Howard Zucker, and I don't know where he is, but he should actually answer that question, which is somewhat outside my expertise. Behind you is Anne Winter, who can put you in touch with Dr. Zucker.
Marilyn?
Just a Marilyn Chase from the Wall Street Journal. Dr. DeCock, just a quick question. When you talk about 24% coverage now in terms of treatment and the progress that that represents over the last 2.5 years, could you bracket it for us? What was the coverage as a percentage 2.5 years ago?
I don't have that figure at my fingertips. It's Thies around. Thies, do you know that somebody know the coverage of 2 years ago? I mean, let me just give you the African example. At the end of 2003, there were about 100,000 people accessing therapy. It's now over 1 million. So there's been a more than tenfold increase. How much? The coverage at in end 2003 was about 3 or 4%.
You need to use the microphone, Marilyn, because there is translation.
Oh, I'm just confirming then that the coverage rate has grown from between 3 and 4% 2.5 years ago to 24% today. Thanks.
Great. Next question. You in the front row.
Terry. I'm Terry Murray from the Medical Post, which is a weekly newspaper for Canadian physicians. My question is for Julio. You mentioned that you're going to be doing some trials in BC to test your hypothesis. Can you talk any more about that?
Thank you. I did mention that we do intend to move to the next phase, which is to actually plan the clinical trial. The Minister of Health has encouraged me to do this, and I'm very pleased that that's the case. The provincial Minister of Health has encouraged me to move in that direction. The health authorities have expressed their support to develop this plan. So has the British Columbia Patients with AIDS Society. And more recently, Gilead has expressed an interest on becoming a partner in this effort. Of course, the details are still to be worked out. In principle, what we are intending to do is take advantage of the opportunity that is afforded to us by the fact that only 50% of the people that have a medical indication to be treated in British Columbia, not unlike as it is in the rest of Canada and most of North America, are accessing treatment. And as you know, we publish extensively on what the reasons are for incomplete access to antiretroviral therapy in our environment, and that can be comorbidities, homelessness, poverty, addiction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Our treatment programs have a bit of a Darwinian perversion quality at the moment. Treatments are available, but you have to be fit to access those treatments. What we want to do is remove that perversion and so bring the treatment to the people that need treatment medically as per current guidelines. And in the process of doing what in my opinion we should be doing anyways, we will have an opportunity to measure the impact that this has on incidence by monitoring incidence prospectively. And in doing so, within a period of about 3 years, expanding the treatment program from the current 4,000 to say 6,000 to 7,000 people, which is our estimate of what needs to be done, we should be able, with enhanced support, And with voluntary testing and treating those that want to be treated, let me emphasize, we should be able to show a similar impact to what we saw in 1996 to 1999 with the HIV incidence. The other thing that is essential to all of these is simpler treatments and rapid diagnostic tests. And there are now technologies that allow us to do rapid testing so that we can go into the communities and have the answer right away. Of course, following all of the norms that were discussed, including the voluntary nature of the testing, the counseling and everything, but having the test available that you can go prick somebody and give the result in a minute changes the dynamics of case finding. So based on what we learned in tuberculosis, case finding, contact tracing, simpler therapies should be able to allow us to enhance capture of antiretroviral, coverage of antiretroviral therapy to nearly as close to 100% of those in medical need as possibly, as we possibly can imagine, and therefore we could characterize before and after transmission situations, and that will give you the answer. Once that's done, we will be in a position to assess the cost effectiveness of these kind of efforts, and in my opinion, whether it works or it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. We've done the right thing anyways.
Take a question from Ed in the front row.
Yeah. Ed Sussman, the UPI. Dr. Dukak, I just wanted to get some figures straight. The estimates of number of people living with HIV/AIDS is somewhere near 40 million, yet we have, you're saying 1.65 million under treatment represents 24%, which means you're aiming at about 6.5 million people to be under treatment. There seems to be a disconnect there on those numbers. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding. The estimate of the global estimate of people living with HIV is 38.6 million. The estimate of people requiring antiretroviral therapy now, that is people who, on the basis of natural history, might be expected to die in the coming 2 years if they didn't access ART, is 6.8 million. The number on treatment is 1.65.
Okay, I take a question from the third row.
Yes, to Dr. Montaner, Daniel Tuleika from Spain. Dr. Montaner, 30 new drugs in the pipeline. What will be the main contributions of these drugs? And from a global perspective, what will be in the story of AIDS, what will be the main contribution of this conference to the story of AIDS?
Well, those are very broad questions, but I'll try to be very brief. With regards to the drugs in the pipeline, I think that if you look at the history of drug development and antiretroviral therapy, what we see is that these compounds are needed predominantly to deal with issues of resistance and treatment failure. The treatment today is working quite reasonably well. Our rates of success are very, very high, both in North America and, as the R-Link has shown, in the developing world as well. Of course, we could improve in various aspects, but the urgent priority is a second, third, and salvage therapies. Second, third line therapies and salvage therapies. I am concerned that this is not penetrating to the rest of the world as it should, and I support, as everybody has said, the need to do something about it so that we engage people on treatment, but then we can sustain them on treatment, and as they fail, we can move them onto treatments that are viable. That's as for the pipeline. On the other hand, your question regarding the role of these conferences, I think that these conferences have tremendous value in renewing our commitments towards the fight in HIV in the world, and even more important than that, in my opinion, to awaken some of those sleeping giants that have been ignoring HIV or have not been doing what it should be done over the years. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We brought heart to the world as a result of the Vancouver conference in 1996. And it's not that the conference did it. although some of us, we were involved. But the IAS strategically organized that conference and took the best science available to put together a story that changed the course of the epidemic. We followed that, for example, and Mark Weinberg, the president of the IAS, has a lot of credit to his. He should be credited a great deal personally for his efforts in bringing the IAS conference to Durban. That was incredibly courageous, but really opened the door for the expansion of antiretroviral therapy that happened. And believe me, I'm not pretending that the IAS has done it all. Absolutely not. But we play a role as a catalyzer, and our friends at the WHO are there to do tremendous amount of work, and so is the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation and a number of others, including PEPFAR, et cetera, et cetera. But we use the International AIDS Conference as a strategic mechanism to open doors, to awaken efforts, and to initiate critical developments that they have a cathartic effect thereafter. So, if, in my opinion, this conference, if you could trace the history of the epidemic around these conferences, and we're very proud of them.
Ruth or Agnes, any comments on how this conference specifically?
I would like to add something regarding the importance of this conference. This conference also opened eyes on future possible gap. We are not there, but knowing that we still have no cure, and all the people, all the 1.6 million who are already on treatment are there for life, and there are still almost more than 4 million who are waiting and dying within the 2 years. And those people will need first-line treatment, but probably those very expensive treatment one day. We have to face this reality. So this type of conference will help all the scientists, the politicians, the donors, the funders, people like Bill Gates, the Jewitt, to face the reality of the epidemic today.
I should probably add that this conference is also a very important occasion for bringing together all the different players in addressing the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It brings in the basic scientists, brings in the doctors, it brings in the community, and it also brings in the media as we are here and the beneficiaries of these treatments. And it gives us a unified look at where the problem is. All the science and all the new drugs will not make a difference for this AIDS epidemic if the community, the communities, the media, and other players are involved. The AIDS conferences also offer an opportunity for people to learn where the science is going and what possibilities are there. I was at the 1996 AIDS conference, and that conference brought ART to the world stage. But that conference also clearly defined the disparities between the developed world and the developing countries. At that meeting, in North America, you already were talking about preventing mother-child transmission of HIV, and you were talking about people living with HIV now, not dying with HIV, but actually living with the disease. And we were in a situation where our children continued to die from HIV, and our children continued to be infected. And I think that was that stark reality was a very major driving force to all the innovations that have come up in terms of prevention of mother-child transmission of HIV, developing new protocols that were simpler and cheaper and easy to implement in resource-constrained settings. So truly, the International AIDS Conferences are a very important forum for developing the agenda around HIV.
Okay, first a question halfway back on the right.
Maggie Fox with Reuters. Just as a comparator, did you guys also get the latest figures on people in the developed world who are getting treated? If we can do a comparator of what percentage of people in the developed world are being treated? Thanks.
Not for this exercise, we haven't.
Okay, Larry was next.
Larry Altman, New York Times. Kevin, WHO set as a goal 3 million people being treated by 2005, and it failed in that. How would you then fill in the blank for 3 by? Will it be 7, 8, 9, 10? When will we get the 3 million of the original goal?
You know, one of your colleagues wrote something that I really took to heart, which was, he said, you know, in economics, you can give them a number or give them a date, but don't give them both at the same time.
give them a number or...
You know, I don't think... I said, it's not wise, including based on experience, to give a number and a date at the same time. So I would hesitate to speculate on a date, but I think, you know, with right now the rate of increase is pretty steady. The danger, I think, that we shouldn't forget about, well, there's several dangers. One obviously is funding. The second one is, though, that treatment scale-up obviously concentrates on where it's easiest to do initially. And if you look at the inequities I described, like children and that Ruth talked about, and injecting drug users, those are more difficult tasks, and therefore certainly may take longer. But on the other hand, don't forget this, you know, 70% of global unmet treatment need is still in sub-Saharan Africa, where scale-up is the most rapid.
Can I? I wonder if I can comment on that. I would like to ask you people for a favor, and it's that through you, we hope that we can rally the masses in the developed world so that they can, with both with their feet, and make themselves heard at the political level, so that our political leaders, for once and for all, do what is right and deliver on their promises. It is very difficult to put Dr. De Kock on the spot, because he's not his bank account that is the problem. It's the donors that is the problem. And we need you to help us to wake them up. And if they don't wake up, wake the voters to tell them that this is not acceptable.
I would like to add also that this 3x5 ideas was a very generous idea. WHO never promised to pay for all. WHO promised to guide the world to reach that point. So that means without such a vision and ideas, probably we will be very far from 1,600,000 people on treatment today. So this is very important, to have good slogan and good vision to lead the world to access to treatment.
I'd like to support that statement that 3x5 was not a failure. Actually, 3x5 was a great success. Today, if you walk the villages of Africa, HIV-infected people know what a CD4 count is, and they know what ARVs are all about. Old grandmothers know that treatment is available, and they are the advocates for treatment. This could not have been possible if we didn't have a clarion call of 3x5. So it gave us a vision, a possibility that could be achieved. And I truly believe that we will get close to universal access.
Okay, the gentleman at the back, please.
Hi, Steve Smith with the Boston Globe. This is for Dr. Bingham Gwal and Dr. De Kock. What is the status of negotiations with funders? As Dr. Benigual mentioned, there's deep concern about funding agreements expiring. Where do negotiations stand, and what is your hope for sustaining those funding streams?
Hope, we have hope. Negotiation is very hard. Because let me tell you something. We have some funder who say, this is the envelope for your country. You want to fund aid, so take in. So we have plan for education, energy, etc. They don't want to keep HIV aid as a specific issue. They want to put in the common basket of support. And in my point of view, it's a failure, because we have put so many people on treatment. We have now a global fund project who is handing. This project called VCT Integre was one of the best of the world. We got all congratulations for management, for transparency, for going over the target before time. It's ending because it's 3 years, it's ending and full stop. So it's not normal. And let me tell you, it's not ethic. And I guess that all the good people in the world should start to have bad dreams about that, what we call in French some cauchemar, because it's not ethic at all. The support should go up to the moment we can take over.
Just to add, I mean, it's not WHO's...
And sorry, I need all you media to be with us in that fight, because Rwanda, we are happy, we have we are not bad. There are some countries who are so bad.
It's not, WHO gets involved in these discussions, but WHO is not a funding agency itself. Neither is it the principal seeker of funds. Treatment scale-up, and I mean, I want to commend what's been done. Treatment scale-up is largely funded through PEPFAR, the Global Fund, and the World Bank. Those are the three biggest sources of funding. And there are other bilateral donors, and to a lesser degree, the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Mark Dybul is from PEPFAR is actually here. PEPFAR is the legislation's up for reauthorization next year. That's a critically important issue. And Dr. Bernhard Schwartlander from the Global Fund is here as well, and he's probably the best person to ask that particular question.
Okay, I know there's been a lot of hands, and we can only take one more question. Take the woman in the back in the middle.
Okay, thanks. I'm Yuan Chan. I'm a Beijing-based journalist. I have a question for Dr. De Kock. VCT has always been seen as the gold standard for testing, but we're seeing increasing calls from national governments, and it seems we're getting hints from the UN agencies also that movement towards kinds of various forms of mass screening, routine testing, and mandatory testing are beginning to gather ground. I'd like to hear what your views on that, whether you think it will undermine the efforts to scale up VCT. And also, you have reiterated in your address that it's very important to respect human rights when talking about these issues. But some governments aren't actually very responsive to arguments from a human rights perspective. So can you tell us from a public health perspective what the dangers are when testing and mass screening is conducted without these safeguards?
Can I clarify one thing? There isn't any UN agency that supports mandatory testing or is calling for mandatory testing. And mandatory testing is a thing on its own. It's quite separate from what others have been talking about as routine testing. They're not the same. I think this is a lengthy discussion. My answer will be brief. I think a first comment is that there are many different categories of HIV testing, all of which have their own requirements. There's the classic VCT, which is tremendously important. It's client-initiated. People do it because as a prevention activity to take charge of their lives, and it's being scaled up very successfully. I refer you to this week's JAMA, the special issue that was released at this conference, which documents Kenya's experience. Very important, very impressive. A very different issue is testing in clinical settings, where people access hospitals, clinics for diagnosis, treatment, and care. The operational requirements are different, and that's the context, and only that context is for so-called provider-initiated testing and counseling. But there are other categories of testing still further for blood, organ, and semen donation, research, surveillance. They all have their separate operational requirements, but there are some commonalities. Consent is important. Consent, confidentiality, counseling, and information. But they're all different in the different contexts. And provider-initiated testing in healthcare settings can be ethically done with informed consent defined as the right to decline. Coercion is wrong, but so is it unacceptable to have people dying with end-stage, undiagnosed, untreated HIV disease and then pretend that that's some form of empowerment. That's nonsense.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop it there. I want to thank all our presenters. I want to thank all of you.